Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
From Wondery Country, I'm Lixidam Dunsett, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. As artificial intelligence swarms almost every aspect of our lives, we're going to hear how the boss of one of the world's biggest media companies is managing the transformation. Alessandro Galloni takes us inside Reuters.
Ooh, you want the dirt, don't you?
That conversation is coming up. Then, Victoria is introducing new laws to unmask anonymous trolls who vilify others online, especially minors. The chair of Digital Rights Watch will explain how the laws are going to work. And it is a huge day in world sport as Spain win their second World Cup.
Unbelievably dominant performance, the most dominant final we've seen from any team in living memory.
We'll get an immediate reaction from Australia's own Craig Foster, and I'll tell you how the US President Donald Trump still managed to steal the spotlight from the Spanish men's side. All of that coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team on The Breakfast Wrap. Where do you get your news? Yeah, I'll admit, strange question to be asking you here, given it's probably The Breakfast Wrap, but where else? How many of us are getting it via artificial intelligence products, whether that's specific AI platforms or some of the inbuilt features on websites that we already use, like Facebook or Google? In a moment, you're going to hear from the editorial boss of one of the world's most renowned media companies, Reuters, about how they're managing the evolution in our habits and even using the technology themselves. Alessandra Galloni is the first woman to have served as the Wire Services Editor-in-Chief in its 175-year history. She's in Australia to deliver the 2026 Andrew Ollie Media Lecture, the annual forum that reckons with an increasingly challenged future for journalism. And before she presents some of her thoughts on stage tomorrow, she shared some with Sally Sara on Breakfast.
What drew you to journalism initially?
Well, initially, and when I say initially, I was about 13, 14, I was drawn to journalism because I loved to write. But then very fast, as I understood the power that journalism can have, I was increasingly drawn to the public mission of journalism, sort of at its core, the idea that journalists, by uncovering truths on the ground, can, you know, do their part in making the world a little bit of a better place.
Did you understand even in those early days that it can be a dangerous profession to speak truth to power?
You know, I didn't. And that is something that I have learned at sort of every job that I've had and every reporting assignment that I've had, but in particular that I have learned since I have been editor-in-chief of Reuters. And that is because the last 5 years since I have been editor, it's been a very tumultuous world, as you know. There have been many conflicts, many wars, which we cover on the ground. And unfortunately, we have lost 4 colleagues in the last 5 years in the major conflicts in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Gaza, and in Ukraine.
How many people and how many locations of offices are you responsible for in this role?
At Reuters, we have 2,600 journalists in 200 locations, but it's about 165 countries. And, you know, we're pretty much everywhere on the ground.
How do you see the challenges of long-standing news organizations navigating the issue of trust in the modern news day?
Trust has always been important, obviously. And for us at Reuters, it's enshrined in our 5 trust principles, which require us to be independent and provide reliable news at all times. But I think it's even more important in the world right now, in a world of AI, in a world of social media, when there is so much disinformation, misinformation. And so I think audiences come to us, sort of mainstream. I know that's a bit of a, you know, what does mainstream mean? But I think sort of trusted news organizations that have been around for a long time, that have original reporting from the ground firsthand, I think audiences come to us because they believe that we will deliver trusted, reliable facts from the ground. And so I think it becomes ever more important. And look, original reporting, it costs money. Then there's a human cost, like I said before. So I think right now, trust is a real currency for news organizations.
Artificial intelligence is already disrupting the media landscape. What challenges have you encountered as a news leader in this time of AI-generated misinformation and also AI transforming the jobs market?
AI is reshaping how we seek news, consume news, finance news. Today, 10% of news consumers globally use chatbots, AI chatbots, to get their news. And that is fast rising. That's almost 50% more than a year ago. And among people under 35, that figure is higher, 16%. And those numbers actually are probably undercounts because they don't include sort of AI-generated summaries, for example, in Google or the AI that's sort of embedded in your news apps or whatnot. So it's huge, right? It is transformational. And I think there's a worry that is about what you were saying, which is the propagation of disinformation and misinformation. So much easier, right, in the world of AI. Wrong facts, fake news, if you will, can be accelerated, not just with social media, but with different AI capabilities. And then there's sort of the business concern, right, which is that the AI companies have taken for free our hard-earned news gathering to train their models and basically stripping our intellectual property. So we have these two concerns. On the other hand, AI used well can be an incredibly powerful tool for our reporting, you know, to examine big data sets, you know, something like the Epstein files, anything that is millions of documents, AI tools will enable us in a much faster way to find trends or connect the dots. So it's an incredibly powerful tool as well.
Alessandra, I must ask you this. The ABC's incoming head of news, Simon Robinson, is your outgoing colleague as executive editor of Reuters. What sort of editorial leader is Simon, and what can Australia expect?
Ooh, you want the dirt, don't you? No, I mean, Simon is an incredible journalist. He has been a reporter, an editor around the world. He really believes in the mission of journalism. You know, uncovering truths on the ground can really make a difference in the world, and he believes this very deeply. He is a wonderful leader. He's run huge teams. He's been instrumental in our new website and in our new digital presence, so he has a real business savvy as well. And he's just a really fun person to be around. So I think you guys are all going to love him.
That is the Reuters Editor-in-Chief, Alessandra Galloni. She'll be presenting the 2026 Andrew Olley Media Lecture tomorrow at 6 p.m. And you'll be able to catch it live on the ABC News Channel and also ABC iView. Victoria is introducing new laws to unmask anonymous trolls who vilify others online, particularly minors. The Premier, Jacinda Allen, is describing the laws as nation-leading.
Whether it's a young woman who's wearing a headscarf or a young boy who's wearing a skull cap. It's why we are going to make it easier for families to take these online platforms to court when they have found that they have caused hurt and harm to young children. These are important changes. These are Australian first changes, amongst the first in the world.
That is Jacinta Allen speaking yesterday. The Victorian government has left the door open to expanding the laws to include people over the age of 18. We wanted to unpack them with someone who really understands this space, and that person is often Lizzie O'Shea. She is a lawyer, she is the chair of Digital Rights Watch, and here is what Sally asked her first.
If we get into the practical aspects first, how difficult is it to unmask an online troll?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting proposal from the government. We don't have a huge amount of detail here, of course, because the laws haven't been drafted. But it does, I suppose, reflect some of the challenges about obtaining information about certain accounts. I mean, there are other contextual issues. So a lot of people also experience vilification and hate from accounts where people use their real names. So there's problems in terms of that exist. But there is, I suppose, some ways in which there can be friction. You know, these are very large companies. It can be hard to work out who to direct requests to. So having a way in which you can access certain information, provided there's a sufficient threshold for harm or for vilification, I think will offer an opportunity to get easier access to this kind of information.
Whose job is it to unmask in this kind of model? Is it the social media companies or is it the victim of the trolling?
Well, it's a good question. So the proposal put says that you'll be able to go to VCAT to seek this information. And I suppose what that means to me, at least, is that you'd have a channel where you could specifically apply to a company. A company has to respond to that request. Now, there are some potential problems practically with that. Part of it is that these companies sometimes, if it requires that they change their business model, you know, if they're forced to collect those kinds of information so that they can respond to those requests, they might not be prepared to do that. And that might make it a much more difficult law to implement. So it really depends on the detail, I think. And I can understand some of the justification because the difficulties speaking to these companies in this way, but there's a lot to go in terms of understanding how this proposal will work.
How easy is it to get this wrong if people are trying to unmask a troll and they actually end up doxing someone who hasn't done anything wrong at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an important question, right? So how hate and vilification happens online is often much more complex than just one person hiding behind an anonymous account. It's often coordinated attacks from multiple different accounts. It might be somebody that is known to you already. So there's a lot of complexity here about how this might work. And that's why I think it's really important that threshold is at the right level. It can't be too low, right? People have a right to have an account and maybe they don't want to know who's running it for good reasons, right? They might have their own specific needs and their identity needs to be protected. So in those circumstances, you have to balance these things up and make sure the laws are working for the purpose that they're intended and make sure that all other opportunities have been exhausted before, say, anonymity is removed.
The Allan government in Victoria is putting forward this proposal as nation-leading laws and or the first in the world. Is that an accurate description?
Oh, it's hard to know, really. I mean, there's a lot of laws around the world that deal with hate crimes and vilification laws and racially discriminatory language, for example. It's not as though it's the case that people have free speech on social media platforms everywhere. Even in places like the United States, there's prohibitions on what you can say. I think understanding them as big bureaucracies that are hard to access, that's one way to think about this and making those processes easier. I mean, in that sense, it's possible it's world-leading.
When you look at what's being put forward, how do you weigh up the positives and the concerns with this kind of model that Victoria is talking about?
Well, I think it is really important that people are able to go online and have a good experience. But what actually happens at the moment is that social media platforms prioritise hateful content, extremist content, and they promote that through their algorithm because it keeps people on the platform. And that, I think, is the big challenge. How can we make sure we impose obligations on social media platforms that make these places constructive, that make them a nice place to be, but also good for our democracy? So while we can talk about individual users being badly behaved, I think there's a big part of the equation here which involves making sure social medias are stepping up to the task in making these spaces constructive in how they design them.
Lizzie O'Shea there, a lawyer and also the chair of Digital Rights Watch, talking to us about these Victorian laws to unmask anonymous trolls online. Well, it brings me immense joy to talk about this at the end of the wrap today. The final whistle has blown after a 105th-minute decider that delivered Spain a second World Cup. Some of the thousands of fans cheering on in Madrid after this nail-biting 1-0 win in extra time, breaking Argentinian hearts right around the world. Before we bring in Craig Foster, I want to bring in our sports correspondent, Chris Glasic, who gave us some brilliant context on what this win means.
They are absolutely going ballistic at live sites around the world. It is a historic win, not just because they've won their second star, adding to their 2010 success, but this is global dominance now for Spain, an unprecedented doubleheader of holding both the men's and the women's world crowns at the same time. Double world champions combining to the women's team winning the 2023 World Cup, of course. They're the first federation to hold simultaneous reigning supremacy across both cups. Also, a defensive masterclass. We give so much praise to Lamine Yamal, so much praise to Ruiz and Rodri in the middle, Olazabal up front, but they conceded only a single goal across the entire tournament, re-establishing a new standard for Spanish defensive rigour and a golden transition. The rising superstar, Lamine Yamal, winning with the veteran captain, Rodri. It's the absolute pinnacle of world football. So much to savour. A few unsavoury moments, of course. We mentioned there Fernandez getting sent off. He's only the sixth player to be sent off in a World Cup final. We'll pour through the stats, I'm sure, but I don't think anyone can disagree that Spain are deserved winners.
Chris Glasic there. Well, Craig Foster. He needs no intro, but I'll do it anyway because he is the former Socceroo captain. He's been a long-time analyst with SBS, now with Stan Sports, and he joined us on the program mere minutes after this match ended as we were listening to the cheers of fans from Madrid to New York. This is what Craig told us about the match.
Yeah, great. Another 23rd final has gone, and Spain, as you say, with their second win. Unbelievably dominant performance, the most dominant final we've seen from any team in living memory, actually. It was absolutely outstanding. But, of course, it took them so long to get that winner and, in the end, thoroughly deserved.
So we went into extra time. It did take quite a while, as you were saying. Also, everyone was kind of waiting on the Argentinian side for Messi to fire up. Did the defence shut him down or he just didn't get opportunities otherwise?
Yeah, the defence did a great job, and the defence for Spain is the best in this tournament. It's the best in the world. They only conceded one goal through eight games, through the entire tournament, actually. And the reason is not defending in the classical sense that we would think of it in other sports. They defend with the ball, that is, they have the ball too much. You know, you can't attack when they have the ball, so they have a lot of possession, and they also are really aggressive and quite courageous in a football sense in the way that they defend. They try and win the ball back very, very quickly, very high up the field, and they were able to do that against Messi. I do think, you know, this tournament was difficult for him. He's 39 years old, and we were talking in recent days about fatigue. I mean, what he did in the semi-final against England was unbelievable in the last 40 minutes. He carried Argentina back into the game and ultimately won it for them with two assists. He just couldn't back up, I don't think. 3 days only between all of the knockout stage. And in the end, that quality of football from a brilliant, brilliant Spanish team was too much even for the great Lionel Messi to carry his team back.
Players are playing in all sorts of different parts of the world at the moment, but is there a distinct European style of playing the game and a distinct South American style? Because we had was the European champion and the South American champion facing off today.
There are very distinct styles between these two teams, that's true. Styles around the world have converged a lot. So, for example, there's a lot of consternation in Brazil because the old Jogo Bonito, beautiful football, beautiful game, as they would say. Or futebol arte, artistic football that they used to play many decades ago, they don't anymore. So there's a lot of criticism that they've become too European. Of course, all of these players get sucked into the vortex of the European game and all the money in the EPL and Spain and France and the like. These two teams, however, were very, very different. Couldn't be more different. Argentina were built around Messi, very aggressive team. They've been quite fortunate throughout the tournament. There's been a lot of conspiracy theories because they have got away with a lot of fouls where they should have been adjudicated on, including in the first half today. I think they should have had a couple of yellow cards. In the end, it was that actually cost them because Enzo Fernandez, the Chelsea player, ultimately got two yellow cards rightly and got himself sent off. Some of his teammates could have also had that. Spain were very aware of that. They didn't get sucked into that type of frustration, you know, individual battles. They just maintained their football the whole time. And in the end, particularly against 10 men, it was almost inevitable that they would be able to break them down. They had another one in the another goal that they had scored, which I thought was wrongly brought back for what wasn't a foul on Otamendi, the defender. So in the end, completely justified, very, very well deserved.
Craig, much earlier in the tournament, Australia exited. We had quite a young lineup. What has this tournament meant for the Socceroos and how are they looking for 4 years' time?
Yeah, the great takeout for us is that this new generation did really well. They stepped up and got a great deal of experience. We saw what Nesta and Kunda did in the first game. Christian Volpato came on more and more and more, and by the round of 32 was starting and the final group game, and showed his brilliance. He's a great, great talent. Lucas Harrington, only I think still 18 years old, our youngest player to play in one of the games. He was magnificent when he had the opportunity to play. So the next generation is very, very exciting. They've had experience in World Cup. They'll be much better for it in 4 years. So we're very pleased about that. In terms of the style of play and the way that we're approaching the games, approaching the tournaments, that certainly needs a very solid discussion now at national, not just Football Australia, but technical and also at fan level. You know, this is our sixth consecutive World Cup. And, you know, we didn't create enough chances, or we didn't create many chances. And so that style of play, I think, really needs to be interrogated for sure. But the great news is that we are starting to once again produce players that can go to the very top level. Without that, the hopes of being able to win a World Cup are very low. And that's why we're also looking at, you know, a national program across the schools to make sure that we can continue to raise the level of our coaching, of our development of kids, both male and female, you know, with a view towards, in a couple of decades, having success at this level. Because we see that World Cup final this morning, and it's right that all, you know, Australians are sit here and we're dreaming about what would it be for us to be playing in these finals. Matilda's made the semi. We want them both in the final, and we want the opportunity to be able to win these magnificent cups.
Craig Foster there, a former Socceroo and analyst with Stan Sport. Well, what an incredible World Cup it has been. It was capped off with commiserations and, of course, the celebrations on pitch as the leaders of Canada, Mexico and the United States all stood on the podium to shake the hands of every single player. But unsurprisingly, one of them stole the spotlight.
And it will be brought to them. The president of the game, the president of the USA.
The US President Donald Trump was always meant to hand the winners the World Cup trophy. That was always the plan, but I'm not sure he was meant to be this involved. Watching the broadcast on SBS, we saw him hand the captain, Rodrigo Hernandez, his prize. He slowly walked in front of the players. He was congratulating them, and he was lingering as they paused, waiting to hoist the trophy and cue the confetti cannons. The FIFA president, who'd spent years winning over his man in Washington, was in the final seconds of this tournament, pictured running across the stage to move Mr. Trump on to give the players their moment. But the moment that will surely symbolise this tournament for years to come, a tournament marred by controversy, divisive visa rules, the backdrop of a global conflict, even a presidential intervention in a red card. The moment that will probably live on is Donald Trump remaining on that stage. As the confetti explodes above him, Spain cheers next to him, and Gianni Infantino, helpless in his attempts to get him off stage, walks off beside him. The US president stood there, clapping and smiling.
In 2026, the champions of the world are Spain!
Spain may be the victors, but Donald Trump certainly made sure he was captured in their glow. Thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from the first episode this week of The Breakfast Wrap. One day down and we have so much yet to cover. All of the interviews were presented by Sally Sara, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Kathy Van Extel. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears tomorrow.